Before we crack on with today's show, listener, some exciting news. We're ringing in the changes here at Haaretz Weekly, and we're delighted to announce the arrival of Haaretz Weekend, an audio supplement to the weekly edition, in which we'll be talking about the many fascinating issues that we're forced to sideline because of the frenetic pace of the news. Haaretz Weekend will be delivered to your pod platform of choice on Fridays, and Haaretz Weekly will be moving to Mondays. And of course, we will continue to bring you breaking news episodes whenever necessary. Given the nature of such news, however, we hope that won't be too often. So, starting next week, look out for Haaretz Weekly on Mondays, and on June the 11th, we'll be dropping the first episode of Haaretz Weekend. And now, on with the show. Hello and welcome to Haaretz Weekly, your audio guide to Israel, the Middle East and the Jewish world. I'm Simon Spungin. On today's show... Fighting may have stopped and the ceasefire is holding for now, but the aftermath of the most recent conflict between Israel and Hamas is far from over. In devastated Gaza, they are counting the human and financial cost. In Israel, the internal unrest, sparked in part by the fighting in Gaza, has exposed a festering wound that is only now being addressed. In North America and Europe, meanwhile, the Palestinian Solidarity Movement appears to have been infected by virulent racist anti-Semitism, leaving local Jewish communities vulnerable and afraid. Joining me today are Haaretz's Amir Tibon and from the Financial Times, Mehul Srivastava. Thanks for joining us, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Hey, great to be here, Simon.
Mehul, you just got back from the Gaza Strip. Tell us what you saw there.
We saw the full might and force of the Israeli military. You walk down a street and you'll see a shattered bookstore, you'll see a bank that's been destroyed, you'll see a multi-story building that's been collapsed upon itself in order to achieve this victory doctrine that the chief of staff of the Israeli military is intent upon putting into play.
Hamas, as you wrote, claimed victory even amid the ruins of Gaza. Is there any sense amongst the people of Gaza that they have won a victory?
It's very difficult for outsiders to understand the mood in Gaza right now, but it is definitely one that's triumphant, while tinged with the sadness of having lost so many of their family members, cousins, children, etc. You have this Palestinian militant group. Israel thinks they're terrorists, and so does the U.S. and the EU, but they are. Somebody said to me that we are the army. That's how they describe Hamas in the Gaza Strip. And in this confrontation about Jerusalem and Al-Aqsa and evictions and all that, Hamas has suddenly shown that they can fire thousands of rockets towards Israel, and all Israel can do is carry out an aerial bombardment that, in the end, doesn't really weaken the group that much.
Mehul, when people talk about the victory, what is the one, let's say, definitive achievement they point to from the Palestinian, from the Hamas point of view?
You know, before I went to the Gaza Strip, I interviewed Ehud Olmert on the phone, and he talked about the Israeli military as being the greatest military empire in the region. And the former prime minister of Israel was hiding in a bunker in the middle of Tel Aviv in the middle of a night while this ragtag army with its homemade rocketry was putting this entire country into fear. If that's not victory for a group that's practicing terrorism, terrorizing people, what is?
Perhaps this feeds into, and I'm reading your excellent reporting from there, despite the death toll, despite the destruction and the despair, all that seems only to have served to bolster Hamas's standing. How do you explain that?
Well, from the people that I interviewed a lot of people while I was there, Hamas didn't kill any of these civilians. The Israeli military did, despite its claims of precision bombing and sophisticated mapping and fantastic target banks. At the end of the day, an Israeli soldier pressed a button and a Palestinian civilian died. And the numbers are, they're always all over the place, but right now we think about 100, 105 women and children were killed, including in a devastating airstrike where three buildings full of middle-class professionals collapsed upon themselves. And the Israeli government called them unintended casualties. So if you're Hamas and you're banking on this emotional resonance that Palestine, Aqsa, Jerusalem, civilian casualties, the brutality of the Israeli army, etc., resonate with them, it did aid them.
The head of UNRWA, the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, had to apologize for comments that he made in an interview with Israel's Channel 12 over last weekend. He described the Israeli offensive as precise and sophisticated. Even if his wording was neither precise nor sophisticated, did you see any evidence to back up his claim that with some exceptions, Israel avoided hitting civilian targets, or the opposite?
Look, I don't think that the Israeli military ever goes out to actively hit civilian targets. But the amount of precision and sophistication required to carry out a kind of narrow airstrike in a place that's as crowded as Gaza is very difficult. I'll give you an example. Sunday morning when I'm in Gaza, I went down to go see the family of a young girl, a 14-year-old, who was killed in her bed. The Israeli military had targeted a building next to her. They took out the entire top floor. 5 to 7 people died. Perhaps they were militants, perhaps they were not. We'll find out at some point. But part of the airstrike bounced across an alley, broke open the wall in this girl's room, and went through her brain. She was 14 years old. She was sleeping in bed. I have no doubt that when the Israeli military planned this airstrike, they had lawyers and they had mapping experts. They had all these things planned out to try and make sure that at least they will hit only that thing. But in a place that crowded, where everybody lives so close together, it is very difficult to avoid civilian casualties. The problem is that we're not allowed into Gaza when the bombing is going on. You only find out after the fact. Mm. So now you have dueling claims. You know, are they targeting civilians? Are they targeting not? We're in this kind of place where we don't know the answer anymore.
Mm. Is it even possible to avoid civilian targets when, as you say, it is very crowded and Hamas is known to put its operations in civilian areas? I mean, there are no areas that aren't civilian areas in Gaza because it's so crowded. There's no sense of resentment amongst the people of Gaza that perhaps live next to something that Israel would consider a legitimate target because it's Hamas or Islamic Jihad. There's no sense of resentment towards Hamas for that?
There's a little bit of resentment, I can guarantee you that, especially for people who, you know, they've bought a house, they've moved in, and then 6 months later find out that Hamas has opened up a little thing right next to them, right? Mm. They understand that Hamas is carrying out a long-term tactic of putting their weaponry, their training grounds, etc., around civilian areas. But they, you know, I want to go see Raji Sarani at the Palestinian Center for Human Rights. He was the first person I met when I walked in. He's somebody whose work I see Haaretz uses quite a bit, actually. And he said something to me that I found really revealing. He says, if Israel wants to kill Hamas, go ahead. Nobody's stopping them. Why are they killing us?
Mm. Among the Gazans that you quoted, Maul, there was an older man who longed for the return to the glorious resistance of the past, and a younger man who had been injured in the recent conflict just wanted to live a normal, happy life. Is that representative of a generational gap in Gaza? Is that gap getting wider?
It's funny you picked on both of those guys because Mahmoud Ajrami, he's well known to the Israeli military. He was with Arafat in Beirut in 86. He was in Jordan during Black September in 1970. I wanted to go see him because even though he's PFLP, he's now considered close to Hamas. And there is a sense amongst this older fighter leadership that years of negotiations and letting Fatah take the lead hasn't gotten them anywhere. Instead, it's gotten a blockade, more occupation, more settlements, this, that, etc. But that if you fight the Israelis, maybe you'll get something back. This is a contagious idea. Mm. But I think for most of the people who live in Gaza, and most of the people who I consider my friends in Gaza, and most of the people who are just trying to live a normal life in Gaza, the blockade since 2007, 8, 9 has been so punishing that they are tired. But I don't see any of them telling me that they know a way out of the blockade other than to confront the Israelis in some manner or the other, politically, militarily, in like the Great Return March a year and a half ago, which was kind of half and half in between those two things. Mm. Acceptance brings pain, violence brings pain, and there are really a lot of them are in a lot of pain right now.
Mm. What about the exodus of young people from Gaza that Haaretz has been covering and it almost as a camouflaged expulsion from Gaza, the blockade imposed in order to make it impossible to live there, and then there's this brain drain of young, talented people leaving the Strip. Is that a concern there?
I think that for a lot of people, they understand that the you know, the thing that you, how did you describe it? You described it as forced expulsions? No.
Well, camouflage expulsions was the term that Noa Landau used to describe it in her excellent article.
Life in Gaza is so miserable. If you are lower middle class or poor, you most likely don't have a job. You have electricity 7 or 8 hours a day. Your family is desperate for money. One person with a job is supporting 30 people. If you get an opportunity to go to Turkey or to Qatar or to Egypt to get a real job, then you can send some money back home. That's a huge opportunity to improve your family's life. Most of the people that I speak to, they keep trying to come back because they think of Gaza as home and they think of leaving it. In their political consciousness, I think they would call it abandoning the Palestinian cause. Mm. So they're in this kind of nether zone where you have to make do somehow. Coming back is difficult but not impossible, especially via Egypt. Somebody that I speak to on there, you know, relatively young women who are quite well-educated and by virtue of their jobs, sometimes they're able to travel abroad. I ask them why they don't just leave. And they say, why would we leave? This is our home. Mm. So I think there's a very strong tension between these camouflage expulsions and the desire to stay home and make your home better.
Mm. How have the global demonstrations in support of the Palestinian cause been received in Gaza?
Yeah, they love them. Mm. This idea that the Gaza Strip has been forgotten in the kind of international conversation and that the West Bank gets a lot of the attention and all they do is suffer, for them to see people around the world rallying to at least the cause of the civilians in Gaza is very emboldening. It's very comforting for them to know that they haven't been forgotten and moved on.
Mm. Let's talk about the plan to rebuild, the umpteenth plan to rebuild Gaza. Many countries have already pledged quite a lot of money. Some of them, however, with slightly unrealistic caveats. But there is a concern, as there always is, surely, about how that money will get used. Have you seen any sign that things will be different this time?
So Sinwar, the chief of Hamas in the Gaza Strip yesterday said, you know, you guys can spend the money how you see fit. We don't need any for Hamas or the Qassam Brigades because we have our own sources. But Gaza's so small. The minute you bring in money to rebuild a road, that's less money that Hamas has to spend on refixing the road. It frees up more resources for its military planning. Mm. And this idea that you're going to spend the money through Qatar or the Saudis or the Egyptians or for the PA, okay. But in a place so small where Hamas runs everything, money will leach away. We don't know what percentage. We don't know how this works. You know, most Israelis don't think about how Qatar pays the salaries for civilian employees. You know, somebody drives to Amman, fills a suitcase full of cash, drives through Israel, crosses the Erez checkpoint. People are throwing flowers at his car. He goes up to a post office, and everybody gets a $100 bill. That's less money Hamas has to spend keeping the civilian infrastructure alive that it has to spend. Frees it up to spend on its military infrastructure. So
Secretary of State Blinken's insistence that the emergency American aid mustn't benefit Hamas, unrealistic, as Hamas will benefit financially or politically.
Indirectly, absolutely. The way these confrontations work is that in the end of the confrontation, at the end of this loss of life, at the end of this loss of, you know, whatever sense of normalcy they have in Gaza, Hamas has to bring material benefits to the Gaza Strip. Should the fishermen be allowed further? Will there be better schools? Will there be more electricity? Will people get 100% of the salary instead of 30% of the salary? And these things are interconnected. So whether Egypt pays or Qatar pays or the U.S. arranges for it, at the end, when the people of Gaza benefit from it, in the back of their mind, they thank Hamas for it.
Mm. And they don't have the reservations that they have with regard to Fatah in the West Bank regarding the siphoning off of money for personal. Feathering their own nests, I think, is the polite way of saying it, perhaps. Hamas is not that corrupt in that sense, but rather siphoning money off for its resistance, right?
Well, you know, how can you judge whether or not Hamas is as openly corrupt as other...
It's like we used to say in Israel that, you know, the Labour Party, when they controlled the country in the early decades, they were corrupt, but they did it for the party, right? This was supposedly the explanation. So, if Fatah, you take it for yourself, Hamas, you take it to build rockets.
Yeah, and then the thing is, you drive around the Gaza Strip, you see a couple of BMWs, you see a couple of nice Mercedes floating around. I mean, they're coming from somewhere. Aid money in the Middle East is often, I don't know what the word is, like the top layer often vanishes. It's not true by any sense of imagination that Islamist militant groups are somehow more pure in terms of corruption than secular ones like Fatah are. But Gaza is small. And where the money goes, everybody knows.
Mm-hmm. One of the causes, according to Israeli analysts, for the recent round of fighting was the cancellation of the Palestinian election. How has the conflict changed relations between Hamas and Fatah? Has it improved them in any way?
Absolutely not. Look, when the elections were canceled, the reason Mahmoud Abbas gave was that Israel is not going to allow people to campaign in East Jerusalem. Mm. Israel is never going to allow people to campaign in East
Jerusalem.
And
never has.
And never has.
Yeah.
It was clear that Fatah, with its infighting and its three lists and Mahmoud Abbas being 85 and unpopular, was going to lose. And that would restart a problem like it had in 2006, a problem without much of a solution. Hamas is now ascendant. It is at the top of the Palestinian question. It's on top of the Palestinian mind. Everybody in the world has to take it seriously. And it managed to do that without those elections. This is a huge problem for the West. It's a huge problem for Israel, because nothing good comes out in terms of stability when Hamas is ascendant. So, yes, the elections were canceled. Everybody in Gaza was talking about the fact that elections were canceled. And at some point soon, elections will have to be held. But we've been saying that for 16 years.
But perhaps nothing good will come out of an election that Hamas is almost certain to win.
Perhaps nothing good comes out of elections in Israel either, where it's not clear who's going to win or not going to win, right? But elections are always a good thing. Free and fair elections, overseen by the UN, run by the EU, they allow people to express their emotions and their anger in such a way that you know where the clear bend of the entire territories are, what they want, where they see the future, what kind of manner of negotiation they prefer. And at this moment in time, if you had elections, it seems quite likely that Hamas would either win outright or come really damn close to winning. And that's why they're not going to be in elections anytime soon.
More likely to have a fifth election here before there's an election in the PA.
And we've become so cynical about elections, Simon, that we need a foreigner to come and remind us the virtues of democracy. You know, we are
elections are good. Elections are good.
Thank you, Merle, for reminding us.
Amir, you live on Kibbutz Nachal Oz, less than a mile from the Gaza border. I can't imagine what it was like for you, young kids, living so close to the fighting.
Well, we are used, first of all, to this reality. I've lived there, you know, overall 4 years with a break in between when I went to Washington, D.C. And one of the differences of living on the Israeli side of the border versus Gaza is that when the fighting starts, you have the option to get away. And we are very, very trained for this. We have gone through several of these rounds in the past. It's very difficult to be in the kibbutz when that happens because Nachal Oz is bombarded 24/7, basically. We are so close to Gaza that Iron Dome doesn't really offer a lot of protection. And Hamas is shooting mortars that can hit any point in the kibbutz. You know, they have a tendency to hit scary places from time to time. In one of the neighboring kibbutzim, a kindergarten was directly hit. And so when I was here at Haaretz on Monday morning at my desk, and I saw the police going into Temple Mount, Al-Aqsa, and using stun grenades to disperse the crowds there, I called my wife and I said, we are not sleeping at home tonight. We have to get out. We have a bag packed for these situations. Everybody who lives in the Gaza border area has this, like a suitcase or a sports bag or whatever, for in case you have to get away for 2 or 3 days. What we didn't anticipate this time is that it was not going to be 2 or 3 days. It would be 2 weeks, where some people go to relatives in other parts of the country. Some people, you have other kibbutzim or moshavim that open up for entire communities. And I think one of the differences in this round of fighting compared to previous ones is that across the Gaza border area, it was empty. You had kibbutzim that usually are home to 400 people, maybe 40 or 50 stayed. Families were encouraged to leave. And I think this is one of the lessons that were learned from a tragedy that happened in our kibbutz, in Nachal Oz, in 2014, when a 4-year-old child, Daniel Tregerman, was killed by a mortar that Hamas shot from Gaza. And in the past, there was this ideological thinking that at times of war, you have to stay. You have to stick to the land, stick to the place, and not surrender to terrorism and leave your home. And I think this tragedy, the death of the 4-year-old child, it changed that perception, and today people are encouraged at times of war to get away.
There's been a lot of research conducted into the mental health of Israelis living in the south, and they've been exposed to years and years of rocket attacks. And the conclusion
20 years now.
The conclusion's always been that the state isn't looking after a whole generation of traumatized Israelis. Is this something that you've experienced, Amir, or heard about from neighbors?
Some people go through it and others don't. I can't put my finger on why. There are all kinds of theories. For example, with children, one thing you hear when you move to that area, and we moved from Tel Aviv, is that a lot depends on what you as a parent show your kids at times of distress, the behavior, the language. Are you acting with a lot of fear and a sense of losing control, or are you quietly, you know, saying, okay, now we are going to the shelter because we have 10 seconds before we hear the boom, and 10 seconds is the official time, usually, mm-hmm. you know, much less, and we are safe here, and you try to kind of show some calm feeling. So that's one thing that that you hear a lot. And I also think it has to do with the community at large. It's not about one person or one family. The whole idea of resilience, I think, comes from a sense of community and purpose. And I would love to hear Mehul's perspective on this in Gaza as well, because I think people there suffer a lot from these conflicts, and they, you know, their options are more limited than ours even. Mm-hmm. And what role does the idea of community, purpose, and support play in dealing with this distress?
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, when Amir was talking, I was thinking about this. There's it doesn't get mentioned enough, and so I'll make sure I mention it right now. There is no doubt that Hamas is close to the legal definition of committing war crimes when it is lobbing mortars and rockets into communities like where Amir lives. Mm. As a military tactic, I can think of no defensible virtue in doing so. And in that comparison with Israel, I do know that the army at least takes significant care not to be directly aiming at civilians, like the stuff around it is the complicated stuff. But in Gaza, these last 10 or 11 days have been described to me as the most intense, scary, nonstop, violent aerial bombardment they have ever experienced. And they've gone through three wars with Israel. And Haaretz has written about this. I've written about it. All military journalists here have written about it. This is a direct result of a new doctrine called the Victory Doctrine that the chief of staff of this military has put into place, which is you will have a deep, wide target bank, pre-vetted. Lawyers have signed off on it, this, that, et cetera. All the military paperwork has been done so mm-hmm. that you can hit play and missiles and bombs will rain down upon different targets all around Gaza. Mm-hmm. So people who would go during the 2014 war, you would have lulls, you'd have gaps, you'd have opportunities to run out and buy bread and food and maybe move to a different camp, someplace that's more safe. This did not seem to be true this time at all.
Mm. And I have to say here that what Mehul is telling, to me, it connects to what I heard from our friends who did stay in the kibbutz this time. And most of the people who stayed, it was either people who work in agriculture and they are running the, you know, basic infrastructure of the kibbutz and they have to stay, and the old-timers, the founders of the kibbutz, people who are in their 80s today, who came there in the 1950s as 18, 19-year-olds to found the community on the border, and they still have this ideological strong belief that you don't leave and you stay. And all of them told us, all of the friends who did stay, when we came back on Saturday after the ceasefire, told us this time the bombing that we heard from our side was much more intense than the previous wars. It was something different. They described entire nights of non-stop bombardment that it's not something that we have experienced before. And when you live on the Gaza border, you learn to recognize the noises. You know when a boom that you heard is Hamas shooting a rocket into the sea because they are training to see how far they can get in Israel. You know when a boom, more like a bit of a silent but vibration, is maybe something happening in Sinai, actually, the Egyptians bombing. And then you know when it's an IDF artillery or IDF planes, you learn to recognize. And you know when a missile is shot at Tel Aviv. And people said this time around, the heavy bombardments of the IDF were something unrecognizable from previous rounds.
It sounds terrifying.
I think for everyone it is, yes.
Our colleague Almog Ben Zikri reported about the southerners returning to their homes on the border with a sense of helplessness, of being second-class citizens, and of just waiting for the next round. Are we going to see any exodus from those areas, Amir?
I doubt it, and I think there are several reasons. First of all, the housing crisis in Israel does not go away just because there is a war. And the one reason that people are moving to our area, it's a beautiful area with wonderful communities, And you have, when there is quiet and peace, I think you have a great quality of life to live in an area with a lot of open land and space and nature. But there is also an economic issue here. And this is a relatively cheaper area of the country because of the security tensions. It allows people to buy homes with an apartments that are larger and cheaper than you would find in other places. That has not disappeared. I also think that one of the lessons that were learned from 2014, as I mentioned, the tragedy in Nachal Oz, after that happened, after Daniel Tregerman was killed, the four-year-old child, you did see an exodus. You did see young families leaving the area, people basically saying, how can I raise my kids here? And I think one of the lessons was that at times of war, you need to encourage families, especially with young children, not to be there so that they are able to return when it's over and not feel like, you know, I can't be here anymore. And I can tell you personally, if you ask my own opinion, I was relieved to come back home. I was happy. And when my one-year-old daughter saw our house after being away for 2 weeks, she smiled and laughed. And when we put her in her room for the first time, she was just so happy. So it is our home. And I can tell you, you know, we are staying in and our friends. But the problem really here is, does the government have a long-term solution? Can we find a long-term solution that would have to include drastic improvements in the quality of life in Gaza as well? Because today, and you know, this has been my belief based on reading and talking to people in Gaza, and I think what Mehul is saying only reinforces it, it seems like people there have nothing to lose. And as long as they have nothing to lose, we are going to be on the losing side all the time.
I think one of the great tragedies of the situation over here is that the shared experiences that Amir has as a parent living near the Gaza Strip with other parents in the Gaza Strip are not shared between these two communities anymore. There's no Israeli journalists there. There's very little dialogue between Israelis and normal residents of the Gaza Strip. But I'll tell you that a very good friend of mine who's lived in the Gaza Strip for a long time, he had exactly the same experience. He moved his family someplace safer. And the day of the ceasefire, I got a message from him saying, look, I got to go back and take care of the garden. And he came in, and I went to go see him. And his children were so happy to see their bedrooms again. And his daughters were running around on the roof with their toys. And his and right across from his house, something had been destroyed. And it is exactly the same shared experience of being held hostage by a military confrontation, which really requires a political solution.
And it's so important what you're saying about people not having contacts, because it wasn't always like this.
Yeah.
The old timers in Nachal Oz, they have fond memories of going to the beaches in Gaza and going to a dentist in Gaza City. And actually, back after Israel occupied the Gaza Strip in 67, the fastest way to go from Nachal Oz to Tel Aviv was to drive through the coastal road in Gaza City. And so people would take their car, go to Tel Aviv or, you know, anywhere else in on the coast in Israel, and on the way back stop in Gaza for shopping, for you know, weekend arrangements. And there actually used to be a surfing club in Nachal Oz, because people would go to surf in the beaches of Gaza. And of course, I think the Israeli disengagement from Gaza in 2005 was the right decision. I really think it was inevitable. We could not continue this military presence inside Gaza, and the idea of having 8,000 Israeli settlers, you know, in this narrow place with 2 million Palestinians is insane. But I do really shed tears over the reality today when there is no contact and no dialogue and no connection. There are some small initiatives with farmers that have happened over the years, when farmers from Gaza would quietly, you know, without too much media publicity, come into Israel, and some cross-border cooperations in that field. But it's extremely limited. And there could be so much more, and it could be for the benefit of people. And the lack of dialogue and the lack of understanding of the different but also shared experiences, I think, is very harmful.
I think perhaps the blockade has blocked not just freedom of movement and travel, but also perhaps freedom of connection and on a human level. And that perhaps is just another of its failed outcomes, as far as Israel is concerned. Mel, before we finish, we're almost out of time,
no,
I'm afraid. We have editors on our desk who've only been with Haaretz for a couple of years. They've managed to cover four elections and a war. You've been here since 2018, right?
Right, January 2018. Right.
So what's been the highlight in journalistic terms of your time here so far?
It's a tough one over here. You know, we've all... covering four elections in a row is difficult, because increasingly you are tracking people's despair at elections to be able to produce a result. That's what elections are supposed to do. You're supposed to produce a winner. And people around the world are like, what is going on? You can't understand this. But I'll say that the journalistic highlights for me over here, the foreign correspondent, are something that is denied to your colleagues.
Mm.
This is this freedom to be able to travel the length and breadth of the land that Israel controls. I could be inside Nablus in the morning, I could be in Tel Aviv in the afternoon, and be in Gaza for the night. I see more of this country as a foreign correspondent than almost any Israeli ever does. And the foreign correspondents and the international aid workers who live here, because of this kind of, I don't know, this lattice, this framework of the occupation, we go places you don't get to go. We talk to people you don't get to talk to. But those people really want to talk to you. They don't care what I think. I work for the Financial Times in London. They're glad to meet me. I'm really grateful for the time that they spend with me. But you are their neighbors. You're their potential friends. And I've had days where, for my birthday, I'll tell you the journalistic highlight. My birthday, 2 years ago before COVID, I went to Gaza for lunch with my colleagues and my friends. And I came back and had dinner in Tel Aviv with my friends. And to be able to do that as a journalist, it's a huge privilege. Definitely a highlight.
Well, hopefully one day as citizens, we'll also be able to do that.
One hopes so.
Mel, it's been fascinating. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Amir, good to see you again.
Thank you for having me and Mehul here.
Listener, we'll be back again next Monday with another episode of Haaretz Weekly. And then at the end of the week, the inaugural episode of Haaretz Weekend. Until then, shalom from Tel Aviv.